Well, again, the resolution reads, the failure of Oregon's experiment in decriminalizing all drugs is compelling evidence that other attempts at complete decriminalization will fail just as badly. Yes, no, or undecided. And here to defend the resolution, Kevin Sabat. Kevin, please come to the stage. Opposing the resolution, Zach Weissmuller. Zach, please come to the stage. Lucas, please close the voting. Kevin, I think you want to take the podium. You have 15 minutes to make your case. Take it away, Kevin.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. I can't really see you with all these bright lights, but I hope you have a good time tonight, and I'm very excited. I want to thank Gene and everyone at the Soho Forum and his staff, Lucas, and everybody for putting this together. They do a great job, and I agree. You know, I don't agree with Nick Gillespie on a lot of things, but I agree with him that we need to do more of this kind of discussion and debate, open debate, and not be afraid of challenging each other's ideas and learning from one another. I think I'm looking forward to learning tonight. I'm excited to be up on stage here with Zach, who I've recently gotten to know and seen, you know, his work. And Zach, you've done incredible work. If you've seen his documentaries on a lot of different subjects, again, may not agree on all of them, but certainly they actually, I think, present a really nice balanced view on a lot of these controversial issues and talk to as many people as possible as you can in a 20-minute documentary. So I want to thank you, and I'm excited about talking about this resolution tonight. I know both of us have spent a lot of time in Oregon, so that kind of gives us an interesting perspective as well. But I guess I'll start by saying I want to sort of make one thing very clear, which is that I'm not up here defending the status quo. So I'm not up here waving the flag of the drug war and saying that everything we've ever done to restrict drugs has been good. Certainly it hasn't. We have one of the highest incarceration rates in the modern world, 4 times our historical average, 5 times any other industrialized country, certainly in Europe. That's not something anybody is proud of. Certainly has resulted in all kinds of inequities that I think we have to absolutely acknowledge. I also think it's important to understand that, you know, and I understand the resolution basically says and kind of takes for granted, but I want to just make sure we're pretty clear on it, that Oregon was a failure. And I think that's very important. I don't think that's just a premise of a argument that I'm going to make, you know, sort of tangentially related tonight. I think it's very important to look at Oregon and what happened in Oregon. Here you had one of the most progressive states in the country that has a wide social safety net. I mean, if anywhere where decriminalization of drugs should have worked, it actually should have been Oregon. And what really happened in Oregon is that they passed an initiative. It was called the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which I don't know anybody against drug addiction treatment and recovery. So it's pretty obvious why that would have passed by a large margin when it did. Interestingly, the campaign was run by groups that want to legalize all drugs. And that's also very important. And I'll get back to legalization and decriminalization and sort of the difference in a minute. But, you know, if anywhere where it should have succeeded, it was Oregon. But it became very clear very quickly that Oregon was a failure. So we had and this is peer-reviewed research in journals. There are sites there, believe it or not. I can send them to you if you're interested. But the 14%, at least, this is a very modest number. I'm using the lower end number, not the numbers that were often used by law enforcement, which were up to 30, 40, 50%. The lower end number is 14%, which is attributed. Let's see if I can get. No, that's volume. That's attributed to it. Let's see which. That's volume also. Let's see. There we go. Property crime was up. The unintentional overdoses much higher than surrounding states. At a rate that was much higher. So you look, and I live part-time in the Pacific Northwest, so I understand, you know, sort of the nuances with Washington, Oregon, what was going on in British Columbia as well over the border and California. But what was happening in Oregon was special and not in a good way. And probably the one that would have surprised everybody if you would have told them that this would have happened before they voted for it, which was that fewer than 1% of people enter drug treatment at the height of this initiative. And the whole point of the initiative, it was called the Drug Treatment Addiction and Recovery Initiative. And people were not going to treatment because essentially what Oregon allowed and what decriminalization is in this country, the political reality of decriminalization, is essentially very, very close to legalization. Now, decrim is a word that I think can mean a million different things to a million people. There's many different definitions. The devil is absolutely in the details. But the reality is, in this country, when we say that we are decriminalizing drugs, and I want to be very clear what drugs we're talking about, and so that you kind of have your mind around that too. And the drugs we're talking about, of course, are drugs like heroin, cocaine, marijuana was already legal, so we weren't talking about that, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, fentanyl, the illegal use of prescription drugs like OxyContin. All of this was considered legal. And it was, I'm going to say, was considered legal, not decriminalized, because before Oregon passed this law, you may not be shocked to know that there was nobody in prison for only using drugs. So this law didn't empty the prisons or reduce the incarceration. People were not being long-term criminalized if their only so-called crime was using drugs. And I want to be very clear about my view. And I hope this doesn't mess up the debate, Gene, and I think, you know, we may agree on some of this, Zach, which is that I don't think people should be in prison and criminalized for simply using drugs. But that's not the reality of when you do something like a decriminalization drug policy. So people were not going to treatment, and I won't read these quotes, but Democrats and Republicans very quickly, and the media, which was enamored in 2020 by this idea of treatment over incarceration, this idea of this ballot initiative, totally turned against it. It was so clear on every single metric what a failure it was in Oregon. And I think, again, it's very important because it's easy to say, well, we'll learn from Oregon and we'll do it better somewhere else. I wish we could do that, but the reality is, you know, if anywhere was going to be an example of the way we would in the United States, which is very important, that we're talking about our culture, because culture is extremely important in policy. There's, you know, alcohol and tobacco are legal in Europe and in other places, but they don't commercialize it and market it the way we do. Canada has had legal federal marijuana since for almost 10 years now. They do not have, you know, gummies with high percentages of THC. They do not sell and advertise in their magazines 99% shatter. They do not have an arm of K Street lobbyists fighting against any decent guardrails or regulations like we do in the United States. So culture really matters. And in this country, a country that's, you know, for many good reasons, celebrates capitalism and ingenuity and businesses getting ahead, my worry is that we are going to be, with decriminalization in this country, it's tantamount to legalization, and we would be, you know, encouraging the use of fentanyl, the use of methamphetamine, the use of crack cocaine. And I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think that's a good thing, whether you're a libertarian, a liberal, a conservative. I don't think it's a good thing for according to anybody, or nor should it be. Because, first of all, if you're a libertarian, the last thing you would want is to increase the state's role as much as you would with drugs that are readily available. Because once you do that, you then have to create the social systems that catch people, that fund, that you have to fund treatment, funding prevention, the issues that are going to happen in other parts of the social system. And what happened in Oregon, and I think what would happen actually in other places, is you'd have this unfunded mandate. Because what was going on in Oregon is you had uncontrollable public use and public dealing. Dealing was not supposed to be legal. So in theory, people were not legalizing fentanyl dealing. But in practice, that's absolutely what was happening. I don't think Zach would disagree with me. And the issue is, that is what happens when you decriminalize these kinds of drugs. Interestingly, Portugal, which is often cited by all kinds of people to sort of defend maybe a lax drug policy, if you go to Portugal, which I also did for my book, I think Zach has as well for his work, and you talk to the Portuguese drug czar, the first thing they tell you is, you know, please tell your fellow Americans that we have not legalized drugs. That is not what we've done in Portugal. What we've done in Portugal is create an administrative system. In English, you call it decriminalization. We don't even really call it that. We've created what's translated from Portuguese into what's called a dissuasion commission. So a government from using drugs if you're caught with drugs. Very different than what we have ever done in the United States in terms of Portugal or any lax drug policy, or sorry, Oregon or any lax drug policy. In Oregon, as you probably know, they gave you, if you were using drugs in public and they happened to find you, and they didn't do this after a few months because there was no point. But in the beginning, when the good intentions were, I think, were there among some, they would give you a $100 fine and a card with an 800 number. Well, while you were in the midst of injecting fentanyl in your veins. And they said, call the number, and you don't have to pay the fine. Well, the fines were never paid. And I visited the phone for my book, which comes out next month. I visited the phone banks, and there wasn't one phone call. There was no one answering the phone because there was nobody calling. And they actually defunded the phone banks because there was no money for the phone banks, and nobody was calling anyway. Of course they weren't, because there was absolutely no mechanism to compel people to get help. And sometimes, you know, the criminal justice system can work with the public health system. Not, it doesn't often in practice, but we should aim for this with things like drug courts, things like HOPE probation. There are ways that when people are committing crimes, often 70% of them are often somewhat drug involved in terms of being under the influence of a drug or having a drug addiction of some kind that's fueling the crime. That's a perfect opportunity to try and get people help. So I really reject this other false dichotomy that we have of criminal justice system versus public health. Because, you know, addiction is a biobehavioral disorder. It has similarities to something like diabetes, a health condition, or heart disease, but a lot of differences as well. You don't steal from your mom for a donut if you're a diabetic. That just is not happening. Or for a Big Mac. You're not lying to your kids because you want to go to McDonald's. I mean, I guess I've told my kid I was going somewhere when I was going to McDonald's once, but generally, you're not doing that. That's not how these whatever, you know, things, fat, grease, sugar, necessarily act on the brain. When you talk about a drug like methamphetamine, when you talk about fentanyl, when you talk about cocaine, crack cocaine, you're talking about drugs that act very, very powerfully on the in the brain and make you do things you really don't want to do. And sometimes the compelling from whether it's a family member, an employer, society in general, look at the rate of smoking in this country. Why has it gone down? Partially, it's gone down because as a society, we have said, you know, we're not going to actually accept this. We're not going to put you in jail for it. And I don't think you should be putting people in jail with an addiction either. But we're also not going to encourage it. We're not going to come out with headlines saying we've decriminalized it and it's open season. So I think we really have to understand that the reality of where, of how this is implemented. You know, Washington State and other states had fentanyl at the time too. Some people will say, well, Oregon failed because fentanyl came aboard. Fentanyl came aboard everywhere. And then they'll say, well, it was because of defund the police. Well, defund the police was not only in Portland. Yes, that was a big part of it, but it was in a lot of other places as well. And by the way, when you introduce things like decriminalization, you also introduce things like defund the police. Whereas most scholars would say, listen, if you're not going to sort of enforce a law on drugs, you should enforce other laws around them to at least make sure it doesn't get totally out of hand. We don't really have a good track record of doing that. You know, when marijuana was legalized, we were supposed to be enforcing all of the laws against illegal dealers. And I don't know how that's working in Manhattan, but when you walk by the thousands of non-licensed stores, the thousands of people involved in the underground and delivery market that do not have a license to sell, enforcing, if you're now telling people we're going to legalize but enforce the rules against the bad actors, that does not happen. And the reality, that is the reality of what it is. So I think there's a theory that I think Zach and I might very much agree with, which is that you should, if you don't sort of enforce drug laws for the user, you should at least enforce them against dealers, you should enforce them against public use, you should enforce them against driving. We would agree with that. I think where we might part, and I'm excited to hear from him, is this idea that that actually happens in practice. And if it was going to happen anywhere, it should have happened in Oregon. Again, a place that is extremely progressive, huge social safety net, a place that has, you know, had actually did not have the wait list for treatment before this initiative ever even passed. So Oregon was our test case. It was a bad example in the United States, at least. And I guess I'll narrow the resolution to in the United States because, you know, doing something in a socialist country like Sweden would be different. You know, in Portugal, if you're caught going to a dissuasion commission, you can't travel outside the country. They limit who you are interacting with. They confiscate some of your personal property. I don't think that's what, you know, my friends at Reason and Nick and others would be suggesting when they say that Portugal might be a good example. But that is what is going on in Portugal. We are not Portugal. We're not a country of, you know, 9.5 million Catholics. We're different. We have a different history. We have a different history with authoritarianism. And I don't see us enforcing, like, doing travel bans among people caught with cocaine in their pocket because we've said we've decriminalized. Doesn't mean we want to criminalize, and I have to finish. It doesn't mean we want to put people in prison for using drugs. I don't want to do that. So I'm sorry again if I disappointed you, Gene. I'm not saying that we should do that. But what I am saying is that having this blanket policy of decriminalization, and certainly what Oregon has taught us, would absolutely prove that it's going to fail elsewhere in this country. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin. Zach Weissmuller for the negative, 15 minutes. Take it away, Zach.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Gene. It is an honor to be on stage at the Soho Forum, and Kevin Sabet, you are a serious and formidable opponent, and I'm excited to have this conversation, in part because I think we do need to reset the discussion around drug decriminalization and what it means and what it doesn't mean. And yes, that does mean acknowledging that what happened in Oregon was a failure and not repeating those mistakes. It also means recognizing that the past 50 years of the drug war have been a failure. $1 trillion spent, lots of incarceration, violence, gang violence, cartel violence, and an opioid overdose epidemic. All of these can actually be traced back to prohibition and the black market and its effects. And we can get into that. But I think that slideshow. I think that all sides, and it sounds like Kevin does not want to repeat the mistakes of the war on drugs. So I think all sides need to admit that if we've been in a war on deadly drugs, that the drugs are winning that war. This is an unacceptable tragedy. I think we both agree, and I think all of us in this room agree, that this cannot go on. And this conversation around decriminalization is about trying to stop this from continuing. It's a devastating tragedy wrought by the status quo, which is why today's question is so pressing. Whether it's true that Oregon's failure to successfully implement decriminalization is compelling evidence that decriminalization should not be tried elsewhere. It's a question that policymakers are asking themselves right now and should be asking themselves right now. And it's crucial that we get the answer right. And by the end of this debate, I think you'll share my view that it's unreasonable and, in fact, irresponsible and dangerous to come to that conclusion, to write off the entire concept of decriminalization based on the peculiar circumstances of Oregon. I'm a journalist. I visited Portland, Oregon just before decriminalization took effect and just after the legislature recriminalized drugs in Oregon. I've also made documentaries about the opioid crisis and the way that people have gone from pills to heroin to fentanyl. I've done documentaries about street camping, homelessness in LA. And along the way, I've talked with drug users, drug policy analysts, police officers. I've read the literature about Portugal, which we'll talk about, and I'll be drawing on all these conversations and experiences to make my argument today, because the picture actually has become quite clear for me as I piece together these perspectives. So let's start with the obvious. Oregon's Measure 110 suffered from terrible timing. You might say the worst timing. You might remember a pandemic hit Oregon early and hard, the Pacific Northwest, and created, let's say, a new focus for the public health system that was supposed to be implementing a brand new system shift where they would be treating drug addicts, substance abusers, and instead resources were shifted to this. And they were supposed to be building out a robust public treatment system. It also caused cities like Portland to ban their already lax street camping bans, and sure enough, tents and open air drug scenes followed. Remember, the point of decriminalization, what Oregon voters thought they were getting, was not a hands-off free-for-all, but a way to shift the already problematic public drug use into a treatment system. And it's very difficult to implement that kind of radical system shift when you're dealing with this. And then, of course, there was this. Portland, Oregon's biggest city by far, was on fire because of Black Lives Matter protests that quickly spiraled into riots and clashes between Antifa and the Proud Boys and the police. There's a police station set on fire. This went on for 6 months at varying levels of intensity. The homicide rate hit its highest in 26 years. And then in the new year, decriminalization went into effect. Police were demoralized. They were already facing funding cuts and a hostile population, and now expected to make drug decriminalization work. So I'd say that this alone settles the debate, that the lesson is not that decrim can't work, but that don't be the first state to decriminalize in the middle of a pandemic and anti-police riots. That might be a reasonable proposition to defend. But there is more. Oregon would have been a particularly bad place. You know, Kevin has said that it's the ideal place. I don't know how he's coming to that conclusion. It was possibly one of the worst places in the country to try this. It worked because they had a very progressive voter base that approved the measure. But Oregon consistently ranked 49th or 50th in the nation in treatment beds per capita before decriminalization. And then they had 90 days to set up this system and become the model of funneling drug users away from the criminal justice system and into treatment. By contrast, Portugal began setting theirs up at least 2 years in advance, and the sort of effort to decriminalize stretches back as far back as 1993. It was officially implemented in 2001. So not great odds for Oregon from the get-go. There's more granular policy problems we can get into: lack of police training, lack of sort of tracking outcome measurements. But I want to get to the bigger picture issue in this opening, which is that this decriminalization does not mean a free-for-all where people get to use drugs whenever and wherever they want. It doesn't even mean legalization, which is what a lot of libertarians would like to see. In the policy space, it means you orient the system towards treating substance abuse disorder instead of punishing it. The European Drug Agency has defined it as essentially nobody is going to go to jail or prison for holding, possessing, or buying drugs. Drug dealing can still be illegal under decriminalization, and then various levels of administrative penalties are still permissible under decriminalization. The point of decriminalization is we're not going to put drug users in jail simply for doing drugs. How did that idea come about as something worth trying at all? Because if you look beyond our borders, beyond our continent, it's been tried not only in Portugal, but several other European countries now, which followed Portugal's lead and accomplished several goals. Did Portugal decriminalize because they suddenly thought drugs are cool, drugs are great? No, they decriminalized because they had a heroin problem, because lots of people were dying from using dirty needles and getting HIV and overdosing, and they had the same sort of street camping that Oregon had. And they decided that throwing people in jail was not working. In fact, it was counterproductive because people go into jail, they kind of dry out, and then they go and use the same drug amount that they were using before, and then their tolerance is down and they overdose and die. So Portugal decriminalized and the results speak for themselves. Oops, sorry. There's HIV cases from needle injection plummeted, which was the primary objective, actually, of the law. Surprisingly to a lot of people, rates of continuation of drug use among adults went down. So what happened is decriminalization went into effect. There was a spike in people trying drugs, but actually a slow decline in people continuing to use drugs over time. That can probably be attributed to the fact that treatment was suddenly the norm there. And of course, we care today a lot about drug overdose rates. You can see that plummet early in 2001 after the law went into effect. And then there is that U-shaped curve that a lot of people, critics of Portugal's system will say, well, that proves that it didn't work that great. But you do have to look at this in context when you compare it to the EU. You'll see Portugal is still far below the average. And then this is another way to look at it. That red arrow is pointing to drug-related deaths in Portugal per capita. Those green lines at the bottom are the U.S. and Puerto Rico. This is one that people don't talk about as much as that I'd like them to discuss for the purpose of this conversation, which is this is the Global Peace Index. Portugal regularly ranks in the top 10. The UN ranks Lisbon as one of the safest cities in Europe, so it didn't exactly descend into like a dystopian hellscape or anything. Now, is it true that, okay, Portugal, they're all Catholic, we can't do anything that Europe does? Well, we have to really look at what Portugal did differently to determine that. And there's two important things, or there's a few important things I want to zero in on in this introduction. One is that we already touched on the implementation timeline, 2 years versus 90 days. There was also the fact that Portugal anticipated that if they became the first country in Europe to decriminalize drugs, what might happen? People might come to Portugal to do drugs, and they did not want that to happen. So what did they do? They beefed up their police force. They went out and they cleared encampments. There's this giant drug scene known as the supermarket of drugs that they dismantled before the law went into effect, and they sent a signal that this is not about a open air free for all. This is about getting people the help they need. The Swiss did the same thing in Zurich. They had zero tolerance for open air drug scenes, gatherings of drug users, which they called in typical Swiss fashion destructive to coexistence. And they specifically wanted to move the scenes inside. And so Portugal and Switzerland and other European countries, it's hard to see, but this is a list of European countries that have implemented various levels of decriminalization. Beefed up policing of public spaces as they implemented decriminalization. Portland rioters burned their police station, demanded defunding the police, and the city council did temporarily reduce their budget, and the city paused street camping removals during the pandemic. It simply does not have to be this way, even in progressive Portland, but certainly not if we're thinking about more functional governments across this grand country. We've got a great thing called federalism here, where people can experiment with, you know, all the social policies that go around decriminalization. Because when you're considering this proposition, I want you to keep in mind that definition of decriminalization. All these other issues about what sort of harm reduction measures do we put into effect? What sort of tolerance of street camping do we have or not have are separate from the question of decriminalization, which is just, we are not going to put people in jail for drugs. And you simply cannot conclude from the particular situation that that Oregon underwent that, okay, we're not talking about no rules at all. We're not talking about legalization, buying heroin at the gas station. we're talking about no criminal penalties for holding or using. And that idea simply has not been invalidated by the experience of Oregon. It's crucial we understand that so we can learn from the actual failures there, which have little to do with decrim as real world policy, and figure out a more rational way to deal with drugs in America. So I urge you to vote against this proposition. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Zach. 5 minutes of rebuttal. You can take the podium. Take it away, Kevin.
Sure. Thank you. Great. Appreciate it. Thanks. A couple of things I guess I wanted to just clear up. First of all, I think it's really clear to remember that Oregon, and frankly a lot of other states, but we're talking Oregon a lot tonight, was never putting drug users in jail before Measure 110. So this idea that we were, all of a sudden, again, people were coming out of prison and they were not going to prison like they were before, that already, and I'm fine with that, by the way. This is not a resolution about that. I don't want to see people going to prison who have a drug use disorder. But the reality is that Oregon was not doing that anyway. And a lot of the country today is not doing that. In fact, if you are in state prison for marijuana, or sorry, for drugs, any drug, that's about 13 or so percent of people in prison. So it's a minority. The vast majority of those people are not there for simple possession and no other crime. If they have simple possession, they have other crimes, and oftentimes those include dealing, etc. I do think it's important to not sort of look at Portugal and something with complete rose-colored glasses. I mean, they again, I spent time in Portugal for a long time, and I'm very familiar with it. They would be actually the first to say these are trade-offs that they have decided to live with, but that their picture is mixed. In fact, if you read the Washington Post from about 1 or 2 years ago, a headline on the front page there was about the second thoughts in Portugal, because they're realizing that what made them have the reductions, which they did experience in the beginning, which they're not experiencing as much now, was the robust investment in treatment and prevention and awareness campaigns. It wasn't the decriminalization part of it, actually. It was the part of major investment in treatment and getting people to treatment, compelling people to go to treatment, which they can do because they have this administrative system. Whereas the Oregon and US style decriminalization, which is not Portugal at all, doesn't do that. And that's a very, very important thing. I think it's very interesting. I've never seen the peace index being used for this, which I think is interesting. I mean, I noticed Singapore was above Portugal, and I don't think we want to be mimicking. I mean, I've been there too, by the way, and I don't want, very nice people and very nice country, but we're not, I don't think, calling for the death penalty for drug users either. It was more peaceful, according to that. That's not the proxy that we want to be, the only proxy that we want to be using. Again, this is not about in my mind, the resolution is not about if you're okay or if you don't want people to go to prison for drugs, then you should vote against this resolution. Or I don't know if we're in favor or against or what we are. I'm in favor, I guess. So, because of the way that it was written, I think I'm in favor. So it's not that you would vote against it if you want people to not be in prison. But I think you would vote with on the yes side if you realize that the way we would be implementing it here in the U.S. would not just be some, passing law that nobody would take notice of. Well, yeah, we've just decriminalized fentanyl and everyone's going to know exactly what that means. It means you still can't use it, but you can't use it in public, but you can use it in private. These nuances are completely lost. And in Oregon, of all places that has one of the most educated populations, actually did have a big social safety net, those nuances were also lost. By the way, I don't see how Oregon was unique. I mean, the pandemic was everywhere, I think. And actually, in general, the pandemic reduced drug use. Fewer people use drugs everywhere. You should be using less drugs during the pandemic, fewer drugs during the pandemic, because of the parental supervision and the other things that were happening. It wasn't a time to be using more drugs. It was actually when drug use across the board fell overall in this country. Seattle had all of the things that Oregon had. They had, San Francisco had more vociferous, frankly, drug culture, more than Portland, and a culture of defund police. They should have had worse outcomes. It was clearly because what was going on in Portugal with decriminalization specifically that I think was a major part of this. So I will end there with my 30 seconds on the rebuttal, other than to say, I think I don't want to just do what the Swiss are doing either, although I admire the Swiss for many things. But I don't think that just moving drug use inside is also necessarily the answer to this. I think we need to give people hope. There are tens of millions of people living in recovery today. Addiction is the only disease where you were a better person after you had it than before you had it. We need to be promoting that kind of recovery, not just if you want to do it, you can do it in this underscript building, just get it out of my face. We got to do more than that. And we're not able to do more than that when we've basically decriminalized drugs in the U.S. style that we would do it. Thank you.
That final rebuttal.
One more slide I want to put up here, if we can. Okay, so this is a graph showing the rise in fatal overdoses in Oregon, according to a study, which you can see the source of up there. That line shows you that 2 years before decriminalization went into effect, overdoses were rising. So, you know, Kevin can, say he can try to disentangle drug decriminalization from these other issues, but I think he would also concede that fentanyl swept the nation during this time period. And you can see it on the map that as the fentanyl moves from the East Coast to the West Coast, the lines all look like this. One inconvenient fact here is that Washington briefly decriminalized and then recriminalized drugs, and their overdose deaths went up after they recriminalized drugs. So my point here is that it's difficult to disentangle what is going on between the pandemic, Black Lives Matter protests, and decriminalization kind of haphazardly being implemented in the midst of all that. It's not to say that decriminalizing in the middle of all of that had no effect whatsoever. We're talking about the future here, and we're trying to evaluate, could decriminalization under better circumstances, where you're not facing all these other pressures, where you're not starting 49th or 50th in the nation in treatment beds, where you're not governed by sort of out of touch progressives who think that you don't need policing, or that you need social workers instead of police in every situation. All these things are not a given when we think about the future of what decriminalization would look like. And if we want to learn from the more pragmatic approaches that we've seen in various European countries, there's nothing inherent to any of these very different European cultures that have done it and the American political system. So that's one thing. You know, Kevin also mentioned recovery versus sort of letting people waste away in a facility injecting heroin. I think that conversation can exist outside of decriminalization. I also, having covered homelessness in California and having critiqued the, you know, just put them in houses approach and it's gonna fix everything, I'm sympathetic to the idea that recovery needs to be a very important, maybe even central aspect to a successful system. It's all, and for the libertarians in the room, this is all also agnostic of how much is done by the state, how much is done by nonprofits, how much is done by cultural changes and cultural messaging. What we're trying to, but the starting point has to be that we're not going to treat holding or ingesting a drug as a crime. And yes, it's true that very few people are in prison for that. There's across the country hundreds of thousands of people in jail for simple possession. We're a big country, so it's a small percentage, but that's still far too many people in prison or jail for that. It also doesn't count the people that are kind of cycling in and out of jail, which is not counted at the state prison level. So there are these injustices we want to fix. There's also just the pragmatism of jail is expensive and ineffective at dealing with this issue. So I hope that we can, you know, again, learn from the mistakes of Oregon, but also learn from the mistakes of federal, local, and state drug policy in this country.
Thank you. Before we go to the audience part of the Q&A, I have just one quick, relatively quick question, I think, the same question for both parties. Let me start with you, Kevin. Question is this: chronic drug users, chronic drug dealers. Do you want any chronic, whatever is offered them in terms of treatment, not interested? Do you want any punishment or penalty at all for the dealers or the users? Any at all? Any penalty or punishment?
Well, I definitely think we need punishment for dealers and certainly those higher up in the system. But I think we can even be smart about that. There's really innovative drug dealing enforcement strategies like the Drug Market Initiative, if you've heard of that. That's actually going on in Seattle and dozens of other cities that essentially actually divert low-level dealers, actually get many of them who don't have access to jobs or economic opportunities, get them help. But the only way you were able to get them to even come to the program is because you have the threat of the criminal justice system. And for over 90% of those people, it's worked. It's been an incredible program. That, to me, proves that there is some role for the criminal justice system when you're talking about such a nuanced issue. You know, so we sort of think of drug use as if we don't want people who are using drugs like fentanyl and methamphetamine and cocaine going to prison, and it's like this narrow sort of band in this vacuum. The reality is the vast majority of those people are also involved in other things that are not great, especially if they're being noticed to law enforcement. So it's much more nuanced than just we don't want the user to go to prison. Again, I don't want that user to go to prison. I'm being very clear about that, I hope. But there are ways, like through drug treatment courts as well, that work very well to sometimes compel people to get the help they need. Because at the end of the day, folks, drug use is a very pleasurable activity. I mean, why are we doing it? We're doing it because it feels good, not because it feels bad. Our brains are saying, this is awesome. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the best food or best sex you've ever had, a natural high, this is 150. Meth is 300. Heroin is like 500. Fentanyl is off the charts. Why would you stop? You don't want to stop. And your brain, which is the most selfish organ in the body, is telling you, you shouldn't stop. It's like, should I grab that second chocolate croissant? I know I shouldn't do it. My brain is saying, do it, do it, do it. And so the reality is, but it's not a chocolate croissant, it's fentanyl. We're not talking about that. We're talking about extremely powerful substances, chemicals, many of them synthetic, man-made, extremely dangerous, nothing natural about it. And some of them have medicinal purpose. I'm not talking about that. But that is very powerful. And so when you bring in a system that can sometimes help, has not always helped, we've not done a great job at it, but that leverage can be very important. The most progressive U.S. Director of National Drug Control Policy we've ever had was a guy named Michael Botticelli. He was President Obama's one, drug czar, they call it. And, you know, he is the number one champion for treatment. He'd probably maybe even vote with you on this one. Hopefully not after hearing me, but in the beginning at least he would have. But a wonderful person. And he says that the only reason he's in recovery today, because he's the only drug czar ever in recovery, it was really cool when he was appointed, the only reason he's in recovery today is the time 32 years ago when he was caught drunk driving and he had handcuffs on him and he had a choice to make. And that was the wake-up call he needed. Again, we don't want that to be the default. I hope people can get a wake-up call other ways. But it's necessary sometimes.
Anybody who sells the stuff, you can be subject to criminal penalties and go to prison. If you buy the stuff, no criminal penalties ever. Can you be fined money? Or can you be it's like a parking ticket.
Yeah, the fines don't work often, but what you need an assessment. What we need to do is actually see if this person has a drug problem. And that's what they do.
But the sellers can go to prison. Okay.
Yes, but there are these other programs I talked about too.
If sellers are in prison, end up in prison, that's acceptable to you.
Depending on the circumstance, yes.
Yes, okay. You heard the question. Same question for you.
Sorry, that was a long answer. Could you just repeat
sellers, the line chronic?
Sellers of drugs, should they go to prison? Buyers of drugs, should they go to prison?
Okay. So what we're debating here is decriminalization. Under decriminalization, sellers can go to prison. Sellers can go to jail. Someone who's holding or consuming or buying drugs cannot go to jail or prison. They avoid the criminal justice system and they face an administrative penalty at most. In Portugal, if they catch someone using drugs in a problematic, antisocial way in public, the police issue them a summons. They have 72 hours to show up for that summons or they will face some sort of sanction. It can be taking away a license, it can be a fine. There's all sorts of administrative penalties of that nature that are non-criminal, similar to traffic ticket. By contrast, in Portland, you could crumple the ticket and throw it away and nothing would happen. You didn't even have to call the 800 number because the legislature repealed even a penalty for that. So my point here is that you can have a different kind of system that has some level of accountability. Again, I know I'm talking to a libertarian audience and that you're not going to like that level of paternalism, but what we're talking about is whether or not an experiment in decriminalization has been, one failed experiment under trying circumstances proves that it can't work under any other circumstances.
You, like Kevin, would countenance putting sellers of drugs in prison.
You mean personally what I would want in my ideal policy space?
Well, the decriminalization that you want, what you favor, what you accept regarding sellers of drugs as subject to criminal penalties that could put them in prison. You accept that?
All I'm saying is that qualifies as decriminalization. Do I think that ultimately criminalizing the sale of drugs makes them more dangerous? Yes, and so, eventually I would like to see a solution to that. But that's a kind of a separate conversation.
Okay.
It's not separate.
Okay. Next question. First question. No need to identify yourself. Just ask your question by question.
Would it be decriminalization if the people caught possessing or using drugs were forced to go into rehab centers where they were forcibly taken to these rehab centers?
Is
that decriminalization?
It depends what you mean by forced. How?
What?
Like the police takes them to a rehab center. Instead of being in a prison, you're in a rehab center that you can't leave until they certify that you're not addicted anymore.
Take it and then
okay.
Is that decriminalization
So decriminalization is no criminal penalties for drug use ever. So there can be administrative penalties like I described, and those are the stick to sort of push people into treatment under the Portuguese system, for instance. So there can be penalties in that sense. I should have shown the slide, but in Portugal, it turns out to be very rare that that happens. Most people accept the treatment, but yeah, there can be.
Comment from you, Kevin.
You tell me if you agree.
What I would say is what your question, it actually gets to the heart of the complication of this discussion, because there are so many different definitions of decriminalization. In fact, when Colorado legalized marijuana, the headline in the Denver Post, you should look it up, in 2012, was Colorado decriminalizes marijuana. They had decriminalized marijuana for 10 years. They legalized it. It was different. And that's what Zach was just referring to. It's a different conversation. So actually, definitions really matter, but they get completely lost. That's my worry in this whole discussion.
Would you be comfortable using the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction
definition? Their definition. Yeah,
yes,
I know.
Which I'm just going to read it for the audience. The removal of all criminal penalties from acts related to drug demand. Right. Acts of acquisition, possession, and consumption. I think that's a fairly, that's a fair working definition. Yes?
It is, but I think the devil's in the details. In the United States, wait, let me just say one thing. In the United States, the decrim was pushed by the number one group that wants to legalize fentanyl, crack, cocaine. That is the political reality of what we're talking about when we often, and we can have these sort of nice discussions in here and have a box definition with, and you know, the, with the European Union Drug Agency, which I think they just renamed, and they're great people. But the political reality is that this often does mean legalization. I think it does matter what your point of view. Actually, that was going to be Mike. I thought we were going to ask questions of each other.
Yeah,
I think it's a question to know about that.
I apologize. You can't ask questions of each other. Just let me jump in. Just again, Zach just read you a definition of decriminalization that he associates himself with. That could be your definition.
From the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction, which defines Portugal's system as decriminalization.
Do you disagree? Do you oppose that form of decriminalization?
That's not the form of decriminalization that is ever implemented in this country or we've ever talked about. So we can talk about the European Monitoring and the Drug Agency we can talk about it, but that's not, I don't think that reflects the reality of what it actually means here in the United States. It certainly wasn't the reality in Oregon. And there's a very good point also being made that Zach's up making actually about the fact that this is what we're talking about in Portugal is a much more paternalistic policy than anyone who talks about decriminalization or legalization in the United States talks about. As I said, restricting travel, forcing, you are arrested, you are put in jail in Portugal if you do not show up at the dissuasion commission. That is completely different. So if you want to talk about that, I in the United States, I wouldn't even call that decriminalization. I call that a slightly modified different thing of what 95% of U.S. jurisdictions do with drug courts. We can talk about that too, but it's different.
By restricting travel, you mean revoking passport as an alternative to imprisonment.
Even within Portugal restricting
travel. Well, I know that there's also one penalty can be you've been using drugs in this area, so you're no longer allowed to go to this area. That's one penalty. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, very difficult here to do.
Okay. That. Yeah. And I apologize for not a slight dementia on my part after so many years. I'm not saying that indeed you have the right to ask each other a single question at any time. You've had a little cross conversation, but Kevin, would you like to exercise that privilege for the moment, or do you want it to wait a little later? Do you have a question that you want to put?
I'm happy to let the others. I do have a question. I have about seven, but I'll ask one. But I'm happy to have
you
others
defer that,
ask,
Zach.
If you're okay with Zach, that, Zach.
Do you have a question?
We'll,
yes.
And then we'll ask.
Yes, I'd like to ask my question, which is: Would if a city or state in the United States built out a robust treatment system and proposed a Portugal-style decriminalization, would you support that?
I'd like to see how that would go. Yeah, I mean, the devil will be in the detail, but I wouldn't necessarily begin. But that again, that's a great what if, and it's a wonderful thing. It's not the reality of this, but I would be happy to see that. And so now I can ask my question.
Yes.
Okay, good. Sorry. I guess my question is, are you okay with a more paternalistic, I mean, it sounds like maybe you are, but I want you to answer it, Portuguese-type system here, if we could do it. It's kind of like the reverse of what you just asked me. And so what I mean specifically by that is the increased taxes that you're going to have, because, by the way, they increased tax. They had to fund treatment. Well, we can't even fund anything here. You want to now fund treatment with non-existent dollars? Because we're not legalizing for tax revenue. That's a separate conversation. So we're just decriminalizing possession. We're legalizing essentially possession. We've taken that is legalizing possession. We've taken away the criminal penalty for it. You can possess, we're saying. So the stuff that you're going to need for that, would you be okay with increasing taxes or how would you pay for it? And also having these kinds of restrictions that Portugal has called for?
So as an alternative to the status quo, I would support that. It would not be my ideal final version of what decriminalization or even full-on legalization would look like, but I think it would be an improvement. In Oregon, the way that Measure 110 was funded was through taxes on cannabis, so it didn't. That's not the case.
No, that, it was a case. Yes. It was a disaster because they're not collecting the many taxes on cannabis, so, and they're paying for the program.
I would not support. I am never going to support raising taxes. I think that there would have to be trade-offs and cuts elsewhere. And in the end, it would be it's cheap. The treatment is cheaper than imprisonment.
Next question.
It seems that the pro side seems to believe that the lack of coercion in the system is what has led to the perceived failure in Oregon. But was the, I think that in Oregon there's also a lack of prosecution for ancillary crimes that go along with drug addiction, like what was up on the screen, property theft, and all sorts of other things. Could that, was that properly used? That could be used to force people into treatment and into all sorts of things. Was that used in Oregon? Would that be something? Also, there's a civil aspect. I know libertarians are mixed on this, but there's the civil aspect of people being unable to care for themselves and being incompetent to care for themselves for whatever reason. They're on the street, they're not taking care of themselves, they're doing all sorts of strange things. You can just leave them to languish, or you could have, civil courts. I know libertarians are mixed on this. Courts where people are declared incompetent and given guardians that who are supposed to act in their interests, and so I doubt that one was tried in Oregon. But the question is, were either of those tried in Oregon, and could they, if not, could they be used to satisfy the concern that you would have regarding the lack of coercion to force people into treatment?
No doubt that it was part of, that there were other things going on. I'm not acknowledging that there wasn't. There was a prosecutor who wasn't going after many crimes, right? And it wasn't just drugs. The drugs, they had the initiative. But other cities had that too. I mean, you had Chesa Boudin, who was also later recalled, in San Francisco, who wasn't going after any crime, but they didn't decriminalize technically. You had Seattle, and then we want to have the side conversation maybe after this about Washington's experience, which was a blip on the radar. I wouldn't really call it an experience in decriminalization, but they had similar things going on too. So I don't know if Washington, in Oregon had done that, if it would have been any different. I'm not sure. I mean, it might have helped the situation. They were certainly not enforcing things. But again, what the implication is that we're going to now have to enforce a whole host of things, spend money on it, increase. If you're saying we don't want to raise taxes, you're saying we need more law enforcement, I think. We need more enforcement on the public use, on the outdoor crimes, and all of these things. I don't know how that's going to happen if we're also not raising taxes and raising, frankly, the state's role in people's lives. And I think what you said is somewhat relevant, but I don't think it's the whole picture.
There's a lot of government waste out there.
Comment from you.
I think it's an important question because it gets to this point of how common is it that somebody is being arrested simply for drug use and doing nothing else? And Kevin has raised the point that it's quite rare. So in a way, that makes decriminalization an easier lift because we're already talking about a small percentage of non-problematic drug users where it's like their only crime is using drugs. It should be fairly easy to say simply using or holding or buying drugs should not be a criminal offense. This issue of drug courts using the criminal justice system, which Kevin has raised as the optimal solution, that can be part of a decriminalization regime for people who have committed other crimes, and a judge determines, okay, the drug use is a primary factor that motivated this crime. Then you can get a judge involved. But what Portugal has done and other European countries have done, and what I'm suggesting here, is that for the person who has committed no other crime, really, jail or prison should just never be an option.
Next question.
Hi, I feel like we've been dancing around a kind of crux question, which is, are you for or against compulsory treatment for drug users in the U.S. Or parts of the U.S., and why or why not? I think both of you cited it as a, you know, major effective source of the Portugal model, and curious how you think it might be implemented here, effectively or otherwise.
Compulsory treatment for drug users. What one let Zach is just... You want compulsory treatment for drug users?
Under decriminalization, that you can, a legal regime can use administrative penalties to incentivize people into treatment. In Portugal, it's fairly rare that they put a resistant user into treatment. They have other options. They'll look at someone and say, you're going to do community service, or we're going to send you to get health care or to housing services. So my understanding is that compelling someone who is treatment resistant into treatment is a heavy lift and not something that Portugal tends to do, but under technically using fines under decriminalization would to compel someone into treatment or otherwise you pay a fine would be a possibility.
Comments, Zach?
Well, I think there's a long answer and short answer. I'll give the short answer, which is it depends. Depends on the situation. Depends on the person. Not all drug use is equal. It depends on whether you're in Honolulu and you're doing it, or they do compulsive in Honolulu, but they also do it in Saudi Arabia. So there are going to be differences with the culture and the way that's implemented. So it really does depend. But what I can say is that it's a heavier lift to ask someone who is using drugs and deriving a lot of pleasure from it, although their world's falling apart around them, they're not contributing members to society, they're causing problems at the workplace, in their family, threatening others, etc., to convince that person that they need help. So compelling them, it really does depend. But there are ways I think you can do it in a way that does not restrict total freedom and also does not restrict their human rights, but also encourages and applauds and the rights of others, because we don't talk about that and who's affected by drugs. We've sort of talked about these things in vacuums, like a fentanyl user who's just using, should they go to prison? They're using. This is not the reality of what drug use is. Drug use is, first of all, it's polysubstance, multiple substances. It's multiple people in your life that are affected by it. Multi-sectors of society that are affected by it. It's a very complex, nuanced issue. So that question, it depends. I gave the medium answer.
I just want to jump in a moment just for something, take another moderator's prerogative. Alcohol is also a drug. You need a license to sell it, but it's been decriminalized. Neither the seller nor the buyer goes to prison. The seller doesn't go to prison. Not that difficult to get a license to sell it. You both agree, though, that you would not decriminalize drugs the way the drug alcohol has been decriminalized. Is that correct?
So legalized.
Again, you can sell alcohol.
We're not talking about legalization. No. Is legalization a good or bad idea? That's something that can be debated, but it's not.
Legalization is defined
allowing commercial sales in the way that it's allowed in Colorado.
Alcohol.
Or California, recreational
alcohol.
Sales.
Alcohol.
Oh, sorry. Alcohol.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, cannabis.
Okay, you both agree about that. Back to the question. Yeah.
This question's for both debaters. So the resolution asks about failure, but how would you define successful drug decriminalization, and what criteria would you look at to make that evaluation?
Kevin?
Well, successful drug decriminalization, what is that the question? What that means? Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, it wouldn't have been the Oregon chart showing, even though they were, of course, experiencing an increase, so were the other states. But what happened after decriminalization in Oregon is that it skyrocketed even more. I don't know if you noticed what happened. I mean, decriminalization was supposed to reduce the overdose. That was the whole point of it. It was supposed to reduce overdoses because we're getting people treatment, not putting them in prison. Instead, it skyrocketed even more. I love that you showed that slide. And in the other places, it did not skyrocket at that level. And in the by the way, fentanyl overall overdoses have abated a little bit, slower in places that have lax policies, that don't have the treatment infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So success would have looked like that reduction, that chart going down. Success would have looked like people actually calling the treatment line and following through with it. Success would have been not the public selling and public disorder that we saw in ways that were much greater than their fellow Pacific Northwest major cities. So I think there's a lot of room where we could have called it maybe a success. But this is really important to the drafters of this law and a lot of the supporters of decrim and the people politically supporting this actually in this country. It isn't really about treatment or decrim or any of that. It is about full legalization. I think that's important to say. So success for them would have been, did 3 years later Oregon just say, you know what, at this point we've decriminalized it, but we need a safe place to buy it, because we've said you can use it, but we haven't said you could buy it. That doesn't make any sense. How could you use something but you can't buy it? You can't sell it, I mean. That doesn't make any sense if you think about it. So that was also the next step, and that is the inevitable next step, would be to legalize fentanyl and meth. So I actually take a very different point of view. I part with Zach on this, which is that this resolution, voting against this resolution, is a vote eventually for full drug legalization. That is what it leads to. That is what it is.
To answer your question, success would look much the opposite of what we're experiencing right now. If you'll remember that chart at the very beginning of the opioid overdose crisis that we are in the midst of at this moment in under a criminalized system. You can go out on the street right now and see it in action. So that would reverse, some of the data that I showed from Portugal. There would be improvements in disease. There would be, success would look like more peaceful and orderly streets. Those are metrics I would look for success. And I was fairly certain that I had conceded, and it was part of the entire premise, that Oregon was not a successful decriminalization effort. So I'm not sure exactly, what pointing out that it was not a success in the data proves. What we're asking you to consider here today is whether that failure proves that failure to implement it in a very flawed way proves that it can't be done.
Thank you. Fred, we're running low on time, so please ask your question, and the debaters might incorporate their answer in their summary statement. But we will just want to go through the four questions remaining. What is your question, sir?
Hello. To both of the debaters. Given the same circumstances, for the same place, for any drug, would full legalization, as already mentioned, give better results, would be more successful compared to decriminalization? And let's give two definitions here before you will answer. Under better results, under more success, I do not mean that either drug use increased or decreased. I don't care about that. What I care about is whether crime increased or decreased. If it decreased, it will be success. It will be better results. If overdose and death from overdose, namely death from overdose, increased or decreased, right. If it's increased, then it's failure. If it's decreased, then it's success. And what do I mean? This is first definition, second definition. What do I mean under full legalization? Under full legalization, I mean no taxes on legalized drugs and no regulations on them.
Well, you want full legalization. Next question.
Thank you. A lot of the data that both of you point to suggests that most of the negative consequences from drug use come from just a couple of drugs, like opioids, methamphetamine, fentanyl, which is a type of opioid. So do you think one of the lessons from Oregon is that rather than treating all drugs the same, we should really focus our resources on cracking down and helping people use those drugs, whilst either decriminalizing or fully legalizing the rest, the many other substances which you see barely no negative consequences of?
Thank you. Next question.
There's been a lot of conversation about the users. I'm from Portland, and I've watched it just be absolutely destroyed. So what value do you place on living in a society without chaos and open drug use, and how does that fit into the hierarchy of needs from a realistic, not idealistic perspective?
Thank you. Final question.
Thanks a lot. Zach, you mentioned federalism. Why wouldn't we take 50 different states, get the federal policy to decriminalize and see which system works best, taking some of the European models? And why wouldn't we have the 12 steps at the basis of it? The 12 steps, I think both of you would acknowledge, and probably Mark Botticelli too, would acknowledge are the most effective ways of getting through addiction.
You're speaking of the 12-step programs, AA?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Those are the four questions. Thank you. We now go to the summary portion of the evening. According to Oxford Style rules, the affirmative goes first with a summary. 5 minutes of summary from you, Kevin. Take it away. You could do it from the chair, or you could do it from the podium.
Fine, here. I want to also thank everybody. I want to thank you for this. I want to thank everybody who asked a question in the last five. They're all very good, nuanced, specific questions. I can't remember them all, but I'll try and put them within. You know, I think that, first of all, some of the questions that were asked just now are very important, because I do think a value of not having a sort of chaotic society driven by addiction, which addiction does drive a lot of other negative consequences. I think I put a very high value on that. And, you know, we can separate the drugs, and, you know, that was asked. But at the end of the day, no matter what drug you're taking, these substances that we're generally calling the illicit substances, these chemicals are acting on areas of the brain and producing a lot of pleasure that make it very difficult to stop. And so the reason we've had a 75% reduction in smoking in the last 30 years, one of the huge reasons is because we have made it more difficult. We've become more restrictive, more difficult to use cigarettes than we ever have before. And that has been a net positive in society. Now, I understand there's also trade-offs, because there are benefits. Individuals that benefit from pleasure, obviously, we all benefit from pleasure. But at the end of the day, I do think that the negatives outweigh the positives on it. If we legalize drugs, which was one of the questions as well, a thorough questions, I think the third to the last one, I think that's very relevant for this conversation, because again, the way our example, you know, somebody once said, someone wise or unwise, depending on where you were, once said that you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. And we're going to these policies with the way that they are defined in our country, the way they're implemented, not the way that we all think in a room of 100 people they should be implemented. And our history is not a very good one when it comes to these addictive substances. We let the tobacco industry lie for 8 decades about the harms of cigarettes and lobby the way they did. We haven't seen alcohol taxes increase, which maybe most people in this room are happy about, but we haven't seen alcohol taxes increase since before the Korean War. When you adjust for inflation, they're actually 5 times lower than that if you adjust for inflation. That's because of a very powerful lobby. So I don't think legalizing all drugs, especially as was asked, with no taxes and no guardrails, basically, you'd make crack, you know, about 3 cents, because that's how much it costs to make it. It's expensive because of the prohibition. Makes it risky. That's why it's expensive. And when things are expensive, fewer people use them. When things are less available and less accepted, fewer people use them. And that's the decrim conversation we're having. Because I just don't think we're going to be able to have a headline that says we've decriminalized drugs, but you need to read the fine print. We're doing it the way that Portugal did it from this year to this year, and we're going to have 2,753 restrictions, and you have to, then we're going to put, the police are going to be over here, so you can't go. We're all going to make sure you don't go to where you were before, and then we're also going to make sure we have treatment over here, and we're going to make sure. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we are going to have what we've seen in Oregon. And we all agree that that was a failure. That is the example we have. I don't want people going to prison for using drugs. But to me, that's not what this resolution is about. this resolution is about. Do we want to, do we think we can implement what Oregon tried to do and get a better result? And I don't think that we can. Oregon was exceptional because they did this, but everything else going on in that city of Portland, which is not a huge city, a modest state, was what was going on in most of the rest of the country, certainly on the West Coast. There was an increase in fentanyl. There was a defund the police movement. There were progressive prosecutors not going after crimes like this gentleman was asking about. And there was a pandemic. And we weren't able to figure it out. That doesn't mean we can't improve our drug policies. I think we can. But I do think 12 steps are important. I do think recovery is important. But I think prevention is the most important thing. And it's very, very hard to do prevention in a circumstance where you're saying that society's kind of okay with it. Because that is what you are voting for if you vote against this resolution, is that you're saying you are okay with the societal message that using drugs are okay. And you're really not going to face much scrutiny. Because I do not believe that those same people are also going to vote for an increase in taxes that you're going to need, an increase in the police state. And we are talking about very powerful drugs like fentanyl. We're talking about what happens in Oregon, which is the average user is not just using fentanyl. They're using methamphetamine, fentanyl. They have a past history of other drug use. It's extremely chaotic. And to think that we can, if we just make a few tweaks somewhere, fix that, we could have made that better, I think is wrong. Thank you.
Jack, 5 minutes of summary. Take it away.
First, I just want to briefly say that, yes, the fact that other cities and states along the West Coast were experiencing upheaval during this time is true, but Oregon is the only one that tried to implement decriminalization during this time. So it does not fall, it doesn't follow that therefore, this was an ideal time to implement decriminalization because other places also were experiencing bad things or have bad governance. The question we're considering here is incredibly important because it's the difference between repeating many of the policy errors that have led us to this very moment of overdose crisis, not to mention the unjust incarceration, ruined lives, gang warfare. It's the difference between that and recognizing that there's another way. I know that Kevin is trying to offer a third way, but he is still ultimately diverting people through the criminal justice system. And people who should not be in jail are going to end up in jail. And while the beauty of America is that it was a radical experiment in freedom, willing to go where no country has gone before, that's actually not required here. European countries have shown that decriminalization doesn't have to be a radical novel experiment in freedom, as much as I love radical novel experiments in freedom. It can be a rather boring and pragmatic way to deal with the reality of mind-altering substances being something that many people seek out, regardless of whether they're legal or not. And that a subset of people develop a serious problem with. Decriminalization, just as much as a legal strategy, is a mindset. Remember, we talked about signaling that the demand side, drug use and possession, should not be a criminal matter, even if the behavior that sometimes results from it can be. There's a whole spectrum of policies, many of which we've discussed tonight, that fall within that paradigm. If you agree that jailing and saddling drug users with a conviction for the crime of drug use is a bad idea, side with me against this proposition. If you think Trump is doing the right thing by declaring war on the cartels and that this is finally going to stop the flow of drugs, you can still vote for this proposition. I'm skeptical. Even if you're unsure about that, and you think that maybe decriminalization is a good idea, but you'd like to see more evidence that it can work in the U.S., and you think that maybe Oregon, with its particularly bad timing, was not the best pilot program for this, you can still side with me if you're persuaded by my case that Oregon was a really bad test case. Because its largest city was racked by anti-police riots and funding pressures at just the moment it needed police to be working cooperatively to implement a new system. Because its streets and sidewalks were already spiraling out of control thanks to a lack of political will and capacity to cope with unsheltered homelessness in a rational way. Because a pandemic was straining an already strained healthcare system that ranked near last in the nation in treatment capacity and faced with just 90 days to get the house in order. We should not accept that the basket case of Oregon is compelling evidence that the much stronger evidence that decriminalization has been and can be an improvement on the status quo is the reality. As policymakers consider what to do next and how to learn from Portland and Portugal alike, I ask you to vote against this resolution. Thank you.
Okay. Lucas, please open the voting. I have in my hand the SOA Forum Tootsie Roll that goes to the debater who moved the needle in his favor. Again, the resolution reads, the failure of Oregon's experiment in decriminalizing all drugs is compelling evidence that other attempts at complete decriminalization will fail just as badly. Vote yes, no, or undecided on that resolution. While you are voting, I want again to invite all of you who've bought a ticket or are in the mood for gate crashing to go to our after party. You are both invited. Can you make it to the after party? Yes, you can. And Zach can too. They will both be there. You can buttonhole them and grill them for all they're worth. You have that to look forward to. Delicious food, two blocks uptown. That's the second mission of the SOA Forum. Now, of course, the SOA Forum continues to do debates. We have it for our November debate. We do 12 debates a year, one every month. In November, the resolution will read, the U.S. Supreme Court's 2023 decision to dismantle affirmative action in American higher education marked a significant regression in the pursuit of racial equality. The affirmative will be taken by Paul Frymer, a professor of politics at Princeton University. The negative will be taken by Jason Riley, an opinion columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and the author of a recent book, The Affirmative Action Myth, Why Blacks Don't Need Racial Preferences to Succeed. We were hoping to have that debate at the Sheen Center, hoping to have it on a particular debate, but other factors intervene. Look it up on our website. It will be held at the Green Space, an auditorium to the west of here. And the only date we could get was November 19th, 2025, which is an important day for me since I'll be 81 years old that day. There will be a cake. There will be a cake with 81 candles on it. You won't want to miss that debate for that reason alone. Lucas, where do we stand with the voting? It looks like Lucas is coming here. Drum roll, please. Okay. Okay. The yes vote went from 24.3 to 44.6. 45.6, it picked up 21 points. That's the number to beat. The no vote picked up 13.6 points. Therefore, it didn't beat the pickup of the yes vote, the Soul Forum Tootsie Roll, therefore, goes Kevin Sabat. Congratulations to you both. So, follow me to the show.